Take me where the promises are real.
I know that it's late and we're probably all in our jammies, but if you can turn on your video, that would really be great because it makes it a lot easier for a speaker to be able to see people's faces when they're speaking. Because, you know, if you're speaking to square boxes, it'd be nice. If you can't, I get it, but think about how, you know, if you were speaking as you'd want some visual feedback while you were speaking too, if possible. All right, so now, Tim, don't fire me or ask me to do this again if you don't want to. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our Nava Zoom room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear tonight's speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. So I was really happy when Tim asked me if I would cheer tonight because that meant that I got to introduce our speaker, who I've gotten to know virtually on Zoom at the 5:45 meeting almost every day for the last 3.5 months or however long we've been doing this now. So I am excited to hear his story because he has got some really strong sobriety and I think he's going to have a fascinating story. So with that, everybody, fasten your seatbelts and I give you Gary.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Gary and I'm an alcoholic and I'm an addict as well. I don't disclose that a lot. However, I do want to preface a little bit. There are drugs in my story, but I will not emphasize them to the maximum. But they had profound influence in my life. And I just give you that, okay? But it will not be one of those stories that just delves into that. I'd like to start out real fast with the third step prayer. And I'm doing that just for my own solace right now. Because as extroverted as I am, I'm one of those perfectionist people, and I've got to let that go. And I know God has this flight tonight, okay? Many of us said to our Maker, as we understood Him, God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. You know, I can't believe I'm reading that prayer tonight because I was never a guy to read a lot of prayers. And I was never, now mind you, I said a lot of prayers when I was in deep kimchi. You know, I came up with some quickies and I found Jesus and God real fast when things were bad. But boy, I sure could dissolve that relationship as soon as I had control and I knew everything was better again. Because Gary Wayne, and when I use my middle name, we're serious now, he just knew what he was doing. Thank God for a good sponsor this time around. I'm a recidivism guy. I've been through the Macy's revolving door in, out, in, out, in, out. You know, I'd find a floor that I liked, and I'd shop around, and I'd get the hell out. Then I'd go to another floor and look for the same thing, but never found it. Same insanity, around and around. And finally, my day came a year and a half ago when the chips were gone, the options were out, and I had to make a decision to save my life spiritually and physically and mentally. But spiritually was the number one problem in my life because I never really embraced it. So we're going to start with the story, and I'm going to do my best not to drag us through because I have many Cliff Note versions, and I'm going to do my best to just make it as concise as I can and deliver the message of recovery. I'm Gary, and I was born in Detroit, Michigan in 1963. My father was a Marine, and my mom and my dad were great parents. They came from very little, and they worked very hard. And I will say this right now, they gave me some of the best values and ethics that a young man could ever want. And did I appreciate that then? Not really, because I was a kid. But as a 58-year-old, I get what it took to get us here. You know, when I was born, I weighed 10 pounds and 14 ounces. And my mother told me that I drank all more formula than anybody. And that should have been an indicator right there. Because I always want more. You know, let's elevate up to the baby aspirin at Grandma's. I love that orange flavor. But I always ate them all. You know, it's that kind of stuff. More, more, more. And it's not really, it's profound now to me because I am actually aware enough and self-aware enough to really look back at my life and unweave a little bit of that tapestry to find some of the misstitches in it, you know. And I have a couple. And it wasn't anyone's fault. It's just the way it was and the way it is. I started drinking and other assorted things probably when we came back from Central America. My father was stationed in San Salvador, El Salvador. He was in charge of security for the American embassies regionally. It was big, and it was a lot of drama. We lived a great life. We lived a very bubbled life, though. It was very protected. I literally couldn't have a bicycle. You know, I couldn't go out very far. My sister and I were always with somebody. You know, it was just a very sheltered world. All of our activities were with people in the American Embassy or the British Embassies, things like this. And it was so classist. I mean, oh, my God. It was just incredible. But, you know, the bottom line is it did not prepare my sister and I for coming back to the United States in 1974, man, because it was a whole new country. I didn't even understand the slang, the lingo, nothing. My sister went right into the drug, sex, rock and roll program. I mean, it didn't take long. And my mom had to go back to work. Really? You have to go back to work? life changed when we came back to good old middle class America. And I say this because this is my thing about never feeling like I fit in at times. I was the guy that came to school, first day of public school, Southern California, and I'm in a damn little vest and plaid damn pants and bell bottoms and patent leather shoes, and all the other kids are in Levi's and Hang Ten jeans and Vans, man. And they were like, who is this cat? And it was horrendous. And then I remember sitting on the playground eating my lunch. I was the guy that unfolded the napkin. I had the four little squares in each one. I put my little fruit cup here, and I put my little drink there, because in El Salvador, we had to do that. I got graded on conduct. I got graded on dress. I mean, it was all this. Man, thank God my friend Tim Bueller down the street rescued me. And he said, what the hell are you doing, Gary? We do not eat lunch like that here, man. Put that shit back in the bag and start grabbing it out one at a time. I said, okay. And thank God he even befriended me. You know, I'm just going to let you know where all this started, because I never felt like I fit in. And that was just kind of the beginning on it. And so, you know, the bottom line is there was angst at a very young age for me. And I learned anxiety probably at a very young age. My mother was very anxious. And I do believe it is, you know, it is, you know, cross-contaminating, you know, so to speak, is catching. When I was in seventh grade, my sister, you know, decided she was going to have her own life, and my father was overseas, and my mother was on her own, and oh, God, it was a crisis. She had a boyfriend, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, my sister moves out, gets an apartment, her boyfriend, and then all of a sudden, I go over to their house on weekends. Yeah, I'm just going over on the weekend, you know, because I was, oh, yeah, I always had the facade, you know. I was the good boy. So I'd go over on weekends and get wasted, you know, and it was drinks and it was weed. It was all of it. Come back home, oh, yeah, I had a good time, you know, and, you know, my mom didn't really catch it, and my dad and mom really didn't notice it. But the bottom line is I already had an escape, and I already had a cover story, and I learned from the best of them. You know, my sister put it all in their face, not me. I'm not stupid. I know where my bread's buttered. And so, you know, it carried into really, it wasn't too much then, really. I didn't, you know, it wasn't a lot. Then when I moved, we moved from from Oceanside, California to 29 Palms, a desert. Oh my God, that was rip-roaring different. And I definitely didn't know how the hell I was going to live there. But the bottom line is that is really where a lot of my addictions, including alcohol, cigarettes, and everything really began. I was, you know, now I'm the city boy in Southern California going to the high desert, and that was a whole different venue. And so I did everything I could to fit in, and basically I started smoking cigarettes and trying to act differently just so I could be accepted. Now, mind you, I was still going to school. I never cut class. I love school. I'm an extrovert. You know, I love going. And I love classes, and I got decent grades. I was an ASB treasurer, and everyone's wondering how the guy who smoked on the Hill got it. Well, I had all my friends who smoked on the Hill go vote for me. You know, I was a little politician, very young. I knew how to work it. And but thank God I did, because somewhere I got some kind of a balance of staying somewhat productive. And during that time, you know, I was working in a grocery store. I had adult friends. It was a lot of drinking every weekend. You know, my dad wasn't a fool. You know, he knew the deal. And I remember one time my dad said to me, "Son, if you're drinking too much, you give me a call." Sure. You know, but at least I knew he knew. But, you know, the bottom line is I really ended up graduating and going to university and getting through that. My real crisis came truly when I went to college, you know. I went to a Big Ten school. It was huge, 40,000 people. I had a lot of friends, but drinking just took off. I mean, you know, it was every night. And if it was the weekend, it was definitely every night. And I just want to share, I never learned how to drink socially. It was never a social thing, even in my dad and my uncle's worlds, his brother, and that will come later. But the bottom line is it was always to get intoxicated. You know, no doubt about that. My dad was a Marine, and when they said we were having a picnic, I braced myself, because the last thing I wanted to do was have to hear the philosophy of life, okay? So when I was in college, I just got to the point where I was the independent dependent, and I just really lost myself. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I hated math. I didn't get near the sciences. So I'm home one summer on break, and my dad says, "How about the Marine Corps? Be an officer." I said, "Oh, that'll make him happy." So I think I'm going to be a Marine Corps officer and, you know, make everybody happy. And I had a girlfriend then, Leslie. She had all the pedigree papers, you know, Birmingham girl, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I was gonna get the Sony picture perfect. So I go to officer candidate school. I do well the first time. Then the second year comes around, and I am just not into it anymore. I know it's not for me. I know Leslie's not for me, because now I'm having an identity crisis in my life. I had it for a long time, obviously, but this was the time now where, uh-oh, what are you going to do? And I got to say, there's some parts I thank my parents for giving me honesty and good values to know when I could hurt somebody else horribly. And I knew I had to probably let Leslie go and, you know, allow her to live her life, because I just couldn't do that. I didn't tell her I was gay. I didn't say that. And, but, you know, I made it all about me, but, you know, that it was not good. I broke her heart. I did. But the bottom line is that's when I really started. I was just lost. I started drinking all the time. And I remember one time, you know, and this is the thing, I always thought it was just a drug problem with me, but oh no, I am now starting to really, just now, 57 years old, all of this repressed auto, you know, I'm an autofiler, you know, when something happens, I lock it up so fast, I don't sense it, I move on. That's how I do it. It was an anxiety thing, and I knew how to make it work. But when I really look back, you know, I remember sitting in my damn apartment at Michigan State, and I would be listening to Neil Young, getting, you know, drinking and everything at like 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning. Now, let me tell you, that's a drinking problem. but I couldn't seem to remember any of that. Even this year, this last year and a half, when I had to come clean with my four step, no memory. No, I couldn't recollect where my drinking was a problem. Wow. So the river of denial for me was deep, and I never wanted to understand that at all. So as we go on in university, I end up basically dropping out of school. And, man, what a mess. I ended up returning home to my mom and dad's house. My self-esteem is now going into the negative linear line of like minus 5, 10, whatever. I don't want to hear about my friends and their successes. I'm feeling less than. I'm comparing out, all of that acting out crap. And I ended up managing a restaurant there, and I got into some other forms of drugs. And, one of them was basically, it was crystal meth. And, whoa, for someone who has the energy I have and to think that I needed a power boost, whoa, get back, because it took me down. I also ended up getting a DUI that year while I lived with my mom and dad right in front of their house. Just all the sewer just started coming out of me. And, it was just not good. Then I also wrapped a car around a foam pole, and I survived that one while I was coming at my parents' house. And my father was always a very pragmatic man, and everything was generally a phase for my dad. He'll be okay, et cetera, et cetera. My mom, not so much. My mom knew there was some issues going on. And, it was unspoken, but I knew that she knew that I knew. it's one of those. The bottom line is I and my parents end up moving from California to Texas, where my dad became a headmaster at a Marine Military Academy in Texas. So now I'm on my own in Palm Springs, and I'm fast forwarding a bit. I get this little studio apartment, and at that point, I was habilitating retarded adults. I learned a lot. I taught them how to use the kitchen and do things. But, it wasn't exactly the wonder job, but I was doing something. But my disease just caught up with me even more and more. Drinking every night, going out to the bars, Daddy Warbucks was my favorite one. And, just with bad news. So then I decided, God, I meet somebody in Palm Springs one night. This is the trip. His name was Bill. And I really owe Bill, if he's still alive, an amend. I really do. And I just thought of him recently. So I'll be doing another four-step one day. However, this is the guy that I meet on a weekend encounter. And next thing you know, I'm flying to Calgary, Canada. And I end up in his front porch. Hi, take care of me. Can you imagine? He did. He was a good guy. He did well. And, but he had his own issues. He was an alcoholic, yada, yada, yada. Funny how we magnate to that, right? We just know. We don't know, but we do it. Anyway, the bottom line is I'm working in Canada. I'm doing all this illegally, I meet some friends. And I end up moving out to my own apartment in Canada. Mind you, I have no papers. I have nothing. And now I have this apartment, and I'm a waiter. And holy shit, how long does the show go on? Luckily, Bill had a girlfriend that was all in love with him named Marika. And she hated me, but she had to love me a little bit. But anyway, she said, you can't stay in Canada forever, Gary. And she was right. And then my boss at the restaurant said, I can't continue doing this because, Revenue Canada is not going to like me. So I understood that. So one night, and I'm just saying this, I'm watching a TV special, and it's an Irving Berlin special on America. I think it was the 4th of July. I don't know what it is about the 4th of July, but somewhere it was a divine intervention between God and country and me. And I'm just watching that, and I'm starting to cry, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I got to get back to my homeland. Ah. So, I end up basically doing a really shitty thing, and I go to Bill's office, and I take a check from the bottom of his drawer, and I write it to a travel agency and get myself back to the United States. I was back. Then I stayed with a friend there, and I decided, what the hell are you going to do? So I said, I'm going to join the military. Hey, where can I get fed? Where can I get a check? And where can I at least get some semblance of, you know, decorum and respect, because I am bottomed out. So I do that, and I go to the Air Force because they get all the money, but they were closed. I said, I'm not going to the Marine Corps because they don't have, you know, I know what they do. So I go to the Navy. So I go into the Navy recruiter. I get, you know, he loves me. He wants my number. He's getting his quota. And the next day, we're driving down to the depot center where I would transition to a bus in Ontario to go on to San Diego to get admitted. I'm sitting in the office. I overhear the commander speaking, and he says, yes, sir, we'll start your analysis today. I'm like, oh, shit, I smoked a joint yesterday. Uh-oh, can't go. Now, mind you, I'm in universal clothing because my luggage got lost and all this stuff. I'm looking like a real trip, okay? And so I tell my recruiter, we can't go. I'm having second thoughts. I don't have any money. Oh, man, he's doing, I'll buy your clothes. I'll give you some money. Get me back. So I go back, and I call my father. They're in Texas. I've really worn my parents out by now. You know, they've sent checks for my bills. I wrote them the cash. You know, I was a thief. I embezzled from my parents. That's the bottom line. And anyhow, my father said, it sounds like you need a place to hang your hat. Said, yeah. So I fly on to Washington Dulles because they're there visiting my sister and her husband. So I land there. My sister picks me up at the parking lot and says, man, Dad is not happy. I said, oh, shoot. Now, mind you, we're in the parking lot at Dulles, and she's smoking a few bowls, and I'm sitting there going, God. You know, so we're all a piece of work in my family. So anyways, we get to the place, and my dad says, I love you, but I don't like you. I love you, but I don't like you right now, Gary Wayne. I don't like you. You've hurt your mother. You've hurt me. You know, you're tapping into my frosting. That meant to money. And, you know, I got it. So I joined the Navy, probably to my father's chagrin, but it's okay because really it was the best move I made. And in the Navy, I became a surgical technician. I got a skill, and I realized I really liked healthcare. I'm sorry. I know I'm fast forwarding. I'm just trying to give you the synopsis of life. But I drank a lot in the Navy. It was a condoned thing. You know, you knew you couldn't do anything else because you had urine tests, but boy, we could drink. And we did, and we drank a lot. And, you know, that's really when my drinking became a pattern. And I never thought it was an alcoholic thing, really. I just thought it was just another night out, you know. But after a while, I started catching on because some of my friends that were in the operating room went into the program. My one friend Arnie told me, Gary, you got a drinking problem. I said, oh, shit, really, Arnie? And he was gay as well. We were both gay. And believe me, being gay in the Navy was not a big secret, especially in operating rooms. I got news for everybody. We ran the ORs, okay? The boys ran the hospital, so everybody just relaxed, but we did a damn good job at it. And so it was really a safe haven, kind of, in a way. But the bottom line is that's when Arnie said, why don't you go to a meeting with me? And that's when I first got introduced to AA. And then I just went there to meet people, guys, basically. And I just thought I was going to be real super special. And I found out these people don't want to play with anything, and you don't got a damn thing on them. So I didn't go back, okay, because I couldn't bullshit them. Pardon my French. I couldn't play the game. They were all over it. Then I got transferred to be with the Marine Corps for a year. And while I was in California, I did some things I shouldn't have done with some friends I knew there. And I came positive with the urine test. When I got to Okinawa, it was a bad day. And I knew it was coming. I actually blacked out on the plane just flying from, you know, California, from my mom and dad's on leave to California to get on the international flight to Japan. I mean, I was drinking excessively. And I knew that I was scared to death. When I got there, I did very well. The commander liked me. And about a month later, the report came in. I got dragged out of the classroom, and I was thrown in the DAPA, Drug Awareness Program, yada, yada. And, man, they said, you know what? You popped up positive, and you use drugs, and fill this out. And there was a stack of papers, and I was supposed to tell them my lifelong story of everything I did. And I was in such anxiety, and I was sweating, and I was so, oh, my God, I just filled it out. That's where I realized, you know, I hit a bottom. I was taken in a van. I had a white paper to get signed. I never remembered any of this crap. Believe me, this year and a half when I had to come out, I mean, I was thinking, where have you been? You've been through a lot. Because I was the guy when I first came in this year with my craziness thinking, oh, my God, they don't even have change in a basket in this little southern town because it's full of damn court papers. Well, I had a court paper, too, but it was in the military, and it was only, you know, 30 years ago. But, you know, how quick, I don't remember. So, because that's another part of my defective character. I'm a judger. I'm a criticizer, and it's a long process for me. But anyway, the bottom line is I get introduced to AA through that, and I do all the things. I check the boxes. I do everything I need to do, but I was not into it at all. You know, I just want it off. But mind you, I'm still facing a military court administrative board. My commanding officer liked me, and he only took one stripe, and I thought, phew, I can do that. The executive officer, Commander Epps, not so easy, said, you're not done, Ward, because I'm going to put you up for administrative board. Not a court-martial, but I will have a panel of three, and the majority vote will decide whether you stay in the Navy or not. I said, oh, shit, man. So once again, I call my dad in the United States, and yes, my father had friends in Washington. I don't know what happened, but it wasn't so much then, but here's the real deal, is I needed an attorney, and I go, oh, God, now I got to have a Marine Corps attorney defend me, the drug user. Oh, sure, this is going to work. Well, you know what? I was sitting in my attorney's office, and I was reading University of Mississippi, and I'm going to say it. I said, I think he's black. I hope he's black. He knows about rights. Sure enough, Captain Miles, he came right in, man, and he started talking to me, and he was right to the point. He was dead fast, but you know what? He was good. He delayed every board. He worked almost every little panel that they brought up, got dismissed, and it got to the point where the panel of three was a lieutenant that I played tennis with, a nursing officer, and then they got a guy from the Navy ship line, and he was there, and two out of three, I was, but also Desert Shield hit, and they weren't getting rid of surgical technicians then. Let's not forget, there's always the selfish need of the Navy. So they probably thought Ward learned something, but Ward didn't learn something. Ward got away with it, got back to the U.S., you know, I ended up getting out, I met my partner, John. And, you know, life was pretty good. I went back to school. I got my baccalaureate. But during all this time, I'm still drinking pretty much every night. John and I were wine drinkers, you know, the excusable one. But there's no doubt that Gary always got a buzz on, okay? During that time, I decided to come out to my mom and dad. I had to come clean. I just couldn't lie to them anymore. And the main reason, I can't even say that, the main reason I came out to them was they were coming up for a summer visit. And I said, John, they're going to come here, and you're in a penthouse overlooking the damn Washington Monument. And they're going to say, I know you can't afford this place, so what the hell is going on? There's only one bedroom and a TV room. And we know you're not sleeping out on a pullout. I mean, they knew me that well. So anyways, I said, okay. So I wrote the letter. Because it was the best way to do it. We were geographically separated, anniversaries, Christmas, those aren't the times to do things, so I did it. Surprisingly enough, it was my father who called me first, not my mother. My mother went to play bingo. She couldn't handle it. Threw her right over the edge. My father, this reminded me of the movie Ordinary People, because I really realized that the dynamic in my family. And I really realized how I was raised and what I was really living for. And my father, I realized, had more compassion than I ever thought he did as a Marine. And he called me and said, son, I just want you to know I love you. I didn't raise a bad young man, and you never did like to get your hands dirty. He knew. So I needed to hear that. And I knew if I heard that, I could live with who I was as long as my parents loved me. Vital. Vital. So anyways, let's move on. The bottom line is I'm still drinking, and now I'm still doing some other collaborative things that I shouldn't be doing behind John's back. John was not into anything but alcohol, basically, and he was always the controlled, stoic one, and I was always the extrovert energy bar. Next thing you know, we end up having to move with John's job or in Colorado Springs, and I end up going to nursing school, but I'm now taking Xanax and mixing things up, and it's getting ugly. And, you know, that wasn't good. Then John gets fired from MCI, goes to San Francisco. There's so much dynamic. The bottom line is my sickness just increased steadfast. So, make a long story short, we go back to Washington. John gets diagnosed with Parkinson's, and it's a tough time. But the good news is now I am now master's prepared. You know, I'm making a good living through the nursing process. I manage all surgical divisions and big hospitals, yada, yada. So the roles reverse. And then eventually John gets much sicker, and I move us to Florida so he has more sun and the ability to take in life a bit. And I actually quit my job and go into a lower category, a director of surgery for Joe DiMaggio Children's Hospital. And about 8 months later, I get diagnosed with leukemia. Wow. Blew me away. In that year, you know, it was hard. But I will say, for somebody with Parkinson's, John always caught a cab every day and saw me. And he made sure of it. And there was a love between us that was inseparable. And I don't regret any of what I did for him, because I gave a lot of myself away. I had to do so. And I didn't think twice about it, and there's no resentment at all. I just don't know what to do with it now, my freedom. I don't know what to do with it. But I think what I really, you know, where I'm going is I started going into a real, the last 2 years with his decline and my illness and just feeling horrible. I was on opioids. I was on alcohol. I was on just about everything. You name it, I was taking it. But alcohol was always the base. I'm an apothecarist. My elixir base was always alcohol, baby. So, you know, hey, I can crush a Xanax and that, drink it up, and resume. You know, I love my potions. So anyways, the bottom line is I knew I had to probably get a break from John. I knew things were imminent, and his caregiver, Larry, said, go take care of things. So I bought a home in Georgia. I knew we had to relocate. I knew I would need to be closer to some family because I was, you know, I'm fragile. That's just the way it is. And so anyways, while I'm here in Georgia, I meet my sponsor, Bob. Now it's getting, all of a sudden, Bob takes me on. He also was a recidivizer. He, 6 or 7 times. But he had a spiritual program that I wanted. I can actually say I wanted his spirituality. And he gave it, he shed it on me. Didn't make me, but said, hey, this third step prayer, I would never have known it, but Bob sent it to me. Here's another one you might want to read. You know, oh, okay. You know, I mean, I got all those kinds of things. And I know we're running out of time. I'm sorry. But it got me going, and I really took God back, because I never let go of him. I always believed in God. When I was little, I was always praying to God. Really, naivety of a child is wonderful, because I remembered that. And, you know, I didn't survive a bone marrow transplant. I had a 3-5% chance of survival. I'm a poster child. I'm blessed. And there has to be a pathway he wants for me to follow. And when it says, you know, that victory over them may bear witness to those that I help, man, I have some help. I have some words of love I can share, and hopefully someone can take that on. But while I'm gone, John's caregiver ODs, Larry. I didn't realize that he was IV drug using, whatever. Now, bottom line is he dies. I go back to Florida. I help his family bury him because they didn't have any money, yada, yada. And I get John back to Georgia. And there was a lot of stuff in between that. But anyways, John passes away 30 days later after we got here. And he looked so good, but he couldn't drink anymore. He couldn't swallow. And John chose to die. And I know that. And it's okay, because we had our living wills and we knew what we wanted. With that being said, where I'm at today is, I'm finally accepting the fact that I'm allowed to be free. God set us both free. And it's hard to think that way, but he did. And I have a new freedom of being able to be my own person. I'm discovering a lot of neat things about myself that I really, really like. You know, I got rid of the sports car. I got a SUV. I'm Georgian now, baby. I love a cowboy hat. I like a brim. I like jeans. I'm going to go get some boots. You know, don't care. And I don't have to worry about what outfit I want to wear to the damn meeting every day, man. Anything's good enough around here, and I'm okay with it. That was the crap that used to make me just get wrapped up. I mean, it started at 5 a.m. What suit, what tie, what this, what that, what committee, who's going to be waiting? Oh, I got to get ready for Dr. So. Nah, no more. But now it's peaceful. What does Gary do with no chaos? So that's what I'm working on, trying to balance chaos versus calm. And it's coming together. I'm giving myself a break as far as, I don't mean a break, but letting myself off the hook for some things I tend to self-admonish myself for when I don't need to. It's okay to take care of myself, and it's okay to live my life. And it takes a lot to say that tonight, because it's really what I've had to do for 57 years, and I'm finally getting to live my life. Because I felt I had to live a script for everybody else. In a way, I did. There's no doubt. There were scripts for me. Luckily, I survived some of those. But the bottom line is my uncle and my father were obviously brothers. And my uncle was majorly sick, alcoholic and addict. I found that out because when he was dying of systems failure, I remember my father and I were visiting him, and he said, "Bill, can you go back to my house and get my Darva set?" And my father did. And then I realized my dad enabled it all. He was the fixer. Man, wow. You know, it just hit me. I said, oh, my poor dad. He'd been through a lot, and I never really appreciated what a good man my father was. And sometimes I was just a real jerk. You know, I was spoiled rotten. You know, I remember my father telling me about making a paper Christmas tree in Detroit because they didn't have money for a real one. And I made a joke of it. Did it catch fire when you put the candles on it? I mean, you know. It was horrible. My father just froze. He wanted to knock the livid, you know what, right out of me. I know he did. But he was too hurt to even respond to me. And I remembered that. And I actually think God had some values. And I said, that wasn't good. And I went back and told my father, I'm so sorry. Because it was so cruel. And he's the same guy that called me about coming out. I remember there was a Marine Corps blog, and I shared this one time before already with some folks in another meeting, but my dad had some retired Marines that were talking about the gays in the military don't need those faggots around, all they're going to do is wimp out, blah blah blah. My father wrote back to all of those folks and said, my son's a corpsman, was a corpsman in the United States Navy, he's gay, he has a partner of 20 plus years, that's more than most of you can say about your own relationships. He's now an executive in the healthcare system, and I'm proud of him. And at that point, I was sober that year. I've been in and out of the rooms 34 years, guys. 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. This was one of those, I guess, 1 years. I don't know which one it was. But I was sober because I just came out of a meeting from the church, and I saw that, and I literally sat in my car, and I cried my eyes out because I knew then that my dad was sending me a message that he loved me. And that he was proud of me. And that was always a big thing for me. Did I ever make him proud? And he never said a lot. But those were the messages, and that's how my dad communicated, okay? And I knew that. So with that being said, I have an uncle his brother who's very much an alcoholic, but I had fun with my Uncle Jim. You know, he was a party animal. He was always around somewhere, but we would always stay with him sometimes with my grandma because he lived with my grandmother. But we shared some fun times with my Uncle Jim, too, and I got to have a more jovial part of the Ward family. I come by my disease, very honestly. Both sides of my family have all have addictions and alcoholism, and virtually everybody's died on both sides from it. My aunt on my mother's side and my cousins and everything. So the bottom line is I learned about alcoholism from two ways. One was from the social stoic way, and one was from the jovial way. But I will say, every time my uncle and my father got together, we knew it was going to be an alcoholic night, okay? And no one knew whether Jim or Bill were going to get in a fight or whatever. And that's where I learned some of the anxiety and the trepidation of alcoholism, because I saw that a few times, the family picnic, the barbecue. uh-oh, you know, not so sure. So with that being said, now today, I don't have that in my life. I've made some mistakes along the way. My sister still suffers from this illness. I've learned to stop judging my sister. And thank God I still have a relationship with her and we can talk about things. And I just want her connected somewhere in my world because I will be there when she needs me. As much as she doesn't want to admit it, little brother is generally the one she calls, and that's okay, and I don't want to abuse that. I'm near her daughter right now in Ludowice, and it's okay. I'm building a new home, and I'm moving on. I have great friends in AA now. My God, thank God for the hand of AA. I wish I would have known that when I was sick and got, oh. What I missed is amazing, but what I'm gaining right now is even more amazing. You know, I have people that go to me to Atlanta. I've had a week of visits. A friend goes with me, stays with me. You know, man, what can you ask for? People that come and take care of my home and my animals while I'm doing these medical needs. People that care enough about me. Yeah, wow. And these were those people that I wasn't going to deal with. I couldn't stand those little happy potter people. You know, everyone's just too much for me. Gag me, you know. Well, here I am. I'm on a Zoom meeting every day. I'm doing stuff I never thought I would be doing. And sometimes I got to, like, you know, go, ka-ching, is this really you? I do that. I have those rearview mirror talks a lot going, who the hell is this? Well, it's better than it used to be. I know that. I am at a place that is going to be better every day if I stay with the program. I stay with my sponsor. I stay with every one of you. I love these meetings. I love my 7:30 a.m., man. I'm right there, man. It's my fuel. It really is. And my sponsors finally got me to say a prayer every morning and take a gratitude list. And I have a lot to be grateful for besides things. I'm grateful I wake up. I'm grateful I have health care that can preserve my eyesight. I'm dealing with a lot of things. And there's technology out there, but I'm a blessed person in this country to have the ability to be okay. And I know that's God talking to me, really, I do. There's a couple things I'd like to read before I close this out. And one of them is a letter that my uncle wrote, my Uncle Jim. He never did a four step, said he could never do one. I've been to a meeting with my Uncle Jim. But he did go to AA meetings because he got sick and he did go. I mean, on and off. My father also, not an AA member, but I wrote him a letter. But I'll just do some quick ones here, and if you'll just bear with me, please. This was on February 7th, 1988. I'm sitting in the front room asking God to please give me the courage, faith, and energy, and not to take a drink for His will to be done. In the quiet of that prayer, I heard the beautiful music. The wind chimes outside my door. It was, and pardon me, the writing's not always easy. It was so quiet as I listened to the music, and I knew I was at peace with God. I thought how magnificent and wondrous it was for pieces of metal to strike each other and music to be created, and then going through the walls, the windows, and the door and soothing my ears, and I'm sober today. I thought about AA and realized how invisible to my eyes, God works in a quiet way among us. We sit and we listen to people we do not always agree with, we may not even like, and then let them speak about things. I don't even want to hear. But when the meeting is over, I feel better. And if I maintain the praise God wants me and to have, and I have also learned without ever knowing it, I began to realize God has put this beautiful island of AA in the stormy sea of life for me only, me. But not me, and not only me, but for every alcoholic in the world. A paradise that is not advertised, but growing by leaps and bounds. A place where music, love and understanding and forgiveness is freely given and to be touched by the hand of God. People leave our meeting place and start to enjoy what has been given to us freely flowers, the sunny day, a stormy day, our wives, children, our husbands, father, mother, brothers, sisters, and strangers or not, it may seem, we have always time for a stranger. Surely this can be the only place for an alcoholic like me. Thank God for you people. Just one more thought for the day, Jim Ward. My Aunt Pat sent that to me. And I'd gone to the AA meetings with my uncle, and I did say I was an alcoholic, and you know, he was the guy that said, now my nephew's here, and he just probably feels a little compelled to say that. No one in my family ever wanted to think Gary Ward had a problem. I wasn't allowed to have a problem. It's very dynamic, you know. No one ever wanted to talk about it. I was supposed to be the one that made it. But I know better. I finally know better. I come by some of my denial, honestly, I do. But, you know, time to buck up, Gary, and get it. My last one is from a letter I wrote to my father when I was at my master's in Georgetown, and we went to Gettysburg, the Gettysburg battleground for one of our residencies. Residencies at Georgetown meant go get drunk for the weekend and go to a class in the morning, okay? But the bottom line is it was Father's Day this day, and we were to write somebody that we loved. And I thought of my father on Father's Day, obviously. But I was also in a military setting, and I thought of my father as a Marine. And what a great Marine he was. Dear Dad, and this was on June 16, 2007. Dear Dad, I'm currently sitting on a bench under a tree at Gettysburg National Cemetery. The reason I'm at Gettysburg is because our class has been studying the battle over the past 3 days. Today is our last day here, and we were asked to write someone a letter before we left the cemetery, so I thought of you. I've been thinking of you lately because I realize the sacrifices you've made for our country. It dawned on me how proud I have been and still am of you for serving in the United States Marines. I am also grateful to you for helping me understand what a great nation we're from. However, I never really appreciated the sacrifices of our Civil War soldiers and what the preservation of the Union would mean to us today. I also have a different ideology about the Confederate soldiers. They, too, had a passion to preserve the way of life that they had always known. They, too, were good men fighting for what they believed was right. It was a war that had to be in order for our young nation to evolve into the incredible superpower that we are today. Even though John and I travel abroad for vacation from time to time, I'm always ready to come home in the end. I still hear people speak of America as the land of the free and the opportunities they give. Even from my classmates from modern countries such as Germany and Austria, they hate the taxes. When I hear people today still believing in the American dream, I realize these dreams are possible due to all of the fine men and women who have served to preserve this precious union. So, Dad, as Father's Day dawns tomorrow, I want to thank you for being a great father and soldier who served both his country and his family. I do cherish every day we have together, whether we're near or far from each other's presence. I'm always there with you in thought and spirit. Love always, your son, Gary Wayne. That's my story today. And I know it's ever evolving. I want it to evolve with life, fulfillment, positive things. My parents are not interned yet, and that's been a big disturbance. My dad died when I was in transplant. My sister didn't have really the energy, you know, the energy. It just didn't happen. So it's my goal that the VA cemetery, which is wonderful in Glenville, Georgia, they allow spouses and to bury their spouses with your father. Because I was so desperately wanting my mom and dad to be, I was going to mix their ashes together and put them in the VA. Because I could not imagine separating my parents. They were married 53 years. But the VA lets you do both. And on the back of the one headstone, it's about your mom. And the front of the headstone is your father. And once COVID lifts, that ceremony will take place. I'd like to thank all of you for letting me share my story.
Thank you, Gary, very much.
Thank you so much. What a beautiful story.
Thank you, dear.
Beautiful story, Gary.
Thank you. It's from the heart, and that's... I don't write it, I just say it. Thanks.
I gotta tell you, I really love all of you guys.
I really
Great job. Thank you.
I come to Atlanta a lot. I fly in and out sometimes for medical appointments, and but I will be up there at times, and I really love to meet I want to go to NAB.
I love your campus.
I know there will be a day we all get to meet. I really will cherish that day, and thanks for letting me share, guys.
Thank you, Gary.
First I slip and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me and finally wake and there I see. Look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart. Takes me where the promises are real. And I always long for something to set me free. Take me where the promise is.